These are the real problems with the island of Dr. Moreau.
On Dr. Moreau's island, there are three rules. Don't drink the water. Don't disturb the natives. And whatever you do, don't feed the animals.
Let's go!
New Line Cinema presents the science fiction event of the summer. Marlon Brando, Val Kilmer, David Thewlis. The Island of Dr. Moreau, directed by John Frankenheimer, rated PG-13. Now playing.
The Island of Dr. Moreau is a 1996 American film based on the original 1896 novel, the same name, The Island of Dr. Moreau, by H.G. Wells. The book is considered a science fiction masterpiece, along with a lot of other H.G. Wells properties. The theatrical version of this film was directed by accredited and critically acclaimed director John Frankenheimer. This guy is a masterclass in filmmaking. I mean, some of his movies, The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, The French Connection sequel, that was actually a lot better than most people anticipated it to be. And my personal favorites, Ronin, starring Robert De Niro, and, you know, I'll even admit, Ben Affleck's Reindeer Games. Yes, he is the director of Reindeer Games. He's a very accomplished director, but he wasn't the original director of this movie. He was actually somebody that was brought in. The story of this movie, basically, it's just a mishmash of scrapping together a cast and crew to make this film. And it was, of course, filmed overseas. So the difficulties of the geography of this movie are also going to be put into play here. And if you want to talk about a movie that encapsulates everything about real problems, it's definitely The Island of Dr. Moreau. This isn't the first adaptation of H.G. Wells' novel, though. There was an original film of this, The Island of Dr. Moreau, from 1977, starring Burt Lancaster and Michael York. But that one wasn't considered tumultuous or problematic as this one was. This one, from the get-go, had issues going into it. Now, the original director was this science fiction aficionado named Richard Stanley. Now, Richard Stanley hasn't really made much of a mark in terms of mainstream directing. He's very much an underground, almost punk type filmmaker that a lot of people really looked into his stuff as that. It was very underground stuff. And he's known for the cyberpunk feature named Hardware. Now, Hardware was a movie that very underground. It was released in 1990. And it kind of set point these types of movies that were going to be released in the 90s, like Johnny Mnemonic, Hackers, and eventually The Matrix, really set a template for how to film science fiction films in that nature. He was a big fan of The Island of Dr. Moreau, the book and the original film. He decided that he wanted to make this his passion project. So he began writing a script, and it took him 4 years to develop the script. Now, Richard Stanley was putting everything that he had into the production of this movie. He wanted to go in and he wanted to see it come to fruition. He wanted to write it, produce it, and direct it. And of course, whenever he was going to New Line Cinema at the time, he was asking for quite a bit, but it wasn't too much to where they didn't think that he couldn't get the movie made. His casting was not exactly how it turned out to be. He originally wanted Jürgen Prochnow, who played in Das Boot, Wolfgang Petersen's submarine adventure. That's kind of a word, terrible way to put Das Boot, but he wanted Jürgen Prochnow to come in and play Dr. Moreau. And he had originally casted Bruce Willis and James Woods to fill out the trilogy of actors. And it was going okay, but things started to come into place that the production studio wasn't really keen on. And all of that stemmed from the fact that they hired Marlon Brando to be Dr. Moreau once Jürgen Prochnow could not commit to the film. You bring in Marlon Brando. Now, this was the perfect example of what you would call a snowball effect. He comes in here and just decides to start overseeing everything. He's one of those actors that, especially in the twilight of his career, he really didn't care a lot about things, but then he cared too much about other things. And I'm going to go into great detail about some of the things that he implemented in this film that wasn't necessary at all. Now, before they even got to the shooting location, which was finally settled on a rainforest outside Cairns in New Queensland, Australia, there was some difficulty trying to get the actors to commit to their roles. Bruce Willis at the time couldn't commit to the part because he was being divorced by his then wife, Demi Moore, and so he felt like it would be better to stay home and settle things out with his family. And then James Woods didn't want to commit to the part because he didn't want to travel to Australia, as he assumed that they were going to be filming in the States somewhere. So he was out of the role. Now, what they ended up doing was they casted Val Kilmer and Rob Morrow for the parts that both of these two had dropped out in. And Rob Morrow, he was under the impression that this was going to be a certain adaptation of the film, And before they even settled on the final script, they were doing rewrites and rewrites and rewrites. And he had already seen the writing on the wall before he even got there. He said, no, if you can't even settle on a script, I don't like where my character's going. I'm just going to go ahead and leave. They ended up bringing in English actor David Thewlis. Now, David Thewlis was an actor who's been in a lot of things since then. It was one of his first roles, so it was a big break for him. And no matter what, he was not going to say no to this part. It's a role with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer. Now that Richard Stanley was able to round out his cast, it was off to New Queensland, Australia they go. Now, just 4 days after being in Australia, the production set had already encountered multiple issues. And these weren't just a couple of things where, oh, the paint on the wall doesn't look right, or this hut doesn't typically look like the rest of the jungle scheme that I'm going for. No, these were full-on problems. Like, for example, there was a hurricane on day two of the shoot that destroyed 80% of the set. So that setback right there is already just something disastrous, because you already have to bring people in to come in and rebuild 80% of your set. So that was a huge, huge blow to the set and to the production. And also, there was one thing where hyenas in the area were attacking crew members and extras, and they didn't really have anybody to combat these wild hyenas. So they were basically just getting brutally mauled until they worked out a deal with a local hunter standing watch on the set to basically shoot and fight off any kind of wild hyena attacks. Not that that put the cast and crew on ease, because you're still constantly looking over your shoulder for, you know, a wild hyena from eating your face. Another severe issue was a production assistant was helping set up the office space area for what was going to be Dr. Moreau's office in the film. And they were bringing in furniture pieces from local cottages and everything. So the production assistant brought this lamp, and there was a lampshade on it. And so when she went to go plug it in, and when she turned on the lamp, there was a spider living in a web underneath the lampshade, and the spider popped down and bit her hand. This is very creepy arachnophobia stuff. You know, the kind of the worst things that happened in that movie actually happened to this production assistant. The spider bit her hand, and she had to wait hours before she can reach a medical facility, because they were way out in the middle of nowhere. And by the time that she got to the medical facility, the severity of the bite caused flesh on her hand to melt, and it ended up being incurable. So she's living with this scarred hand, almost looks like a burn. And that right there is traumatizing enough as it is. Obviously, she didn't continue on with the role. She left and went home after that. Director Richard Stanley is already a very superstitious person by nature, so he's already seeing all of these occurrences taking place, and he just feels like it's such a bad omen to be on this set. So much like the creators of The Exorcist, by bringing in a real priest to bless the set of The Exorcist, Stanley decided to do something similar. Well, he brought in his warlock friend named Skip. Now, I don't know too much about warlocks or anything that they do, but I find it odd that one is named Skip. I don't know if that's judgmental or not, but I apologize if it is, but I just thought that was kind of interesting. Well, Skip comes in here and he blesses the set. He flies him in to Australia just for this, because he's based out of New York City. And he comes in, blesses the set, does his thing. And I guess he felt like that was good enough for things to start rolling on a more positive and progressive tone. Well, fast forward to Skip in his real life. He moved back home to New York City, and he was actually a brilliant biochemist. He was very certified and quite accredited by many universities as a speaker of biochemistry. Well, he was having personal issues with his underground laboratory, as wonderful as that sounds. He believed that the clay wall in his laboratory had been too thin, and it accidentally became irradiated during his experimentations, and it caused his bones to literally crumble. Now, one morning, his hip just dislocated as he was getting out of bed, and his leg literally just popped out of the socket. And in the hospital, when they operated, they then caught what was called a necrotizing fasciitis, which is a flesh-eating parasite. And he gained this because of some of the experiments that he was doing in his laboratory. So, unfortunately, his warlock skills couldn't bless his own personal well-being. So I thought that that post blessing of the Island of Dr. Moreau set was quite crazy. But yeah, that was the warlock named Skip that was brought onto the set that unfortunately didn't really work out too well for Richard Stanley himself, because just 4 days into the production, you're seeing all these crazy occurrences take place, all this negative energy, just everything not working out. So Richard Stanley was unfortunately fired and let go from the film. word got back from the studio heads and they said, look, this isn't working out. You don't have a good handle on this. It was a mistake bringing in this indie filmmaker to come in and make this mainstream movie. So they literally fired Richard Stanley from his own set, from his own film. They decided, of course, they're going to keep the screenplay because they don't have anybody else to work things out with. And luckily for Richard Stanley, you still see him credited as a co-screenwriter of the movie. But they brought in another screenwriter to kind of fix things and see if they can move on from there. Now, unfortunately, this won't be the end for Richard Stanley. Or fortunately, if you know you feel like it was unjust that he was removed from his own project, which I personally do. So luckily there is a really great story that we're going to close on this episode with, but that's going to come later that involves Richard Stanley. They brought in John Frankenheimer, as I'd mentioned earlier. John Frankenheimer is a very accomplished and accredited director, and he came in here to try and basically wrangle the wild stallions that were running amok on this jungle set. And those two stallions happened to be in the form of Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer. Now, all of the issues stemmed from these two guys just basically being at odds with one another. Two egomaniacs and two very accomplished directors. Now, there's nothing to take away from Marlon Brando and or Val Kilmer and their ability. Marlon Brando alone, he's one of the greatest, most accomplished American actors in history of cinema. You've got The Godfather, On the Waterfront. Some of the greatest performances are compared to Marlon Brando's classic pieces of work. Island of Dr. Moreau, shockingly, is not on that list. But he is a very accomplished director and very respected within the medium of his peers and critics and fans alike. And, you know, Val Kilmer, to a certain degree, also has that reputation of being a very accomplished actor. Now, I personally love Val Kilmer. I think he has been in tremendous films. He's very well known for various roles, such as my personal favorite, Mad Mardigan in Willow. But a lot of people really look to Val Kilmer as Iceman in Top Gun, and of course, Doc Holliday for Tombstone. He actually received an Academy Award nomination for Doc Holliday because honestly, that's probably his greatest performance, arguably, as an actor. And so, you know, he's coming off of Tombstone and all these other movies that he had done. So Val Kilmer is very high and mighty in this regard. And, you know, he hasn't gone on to play Batman yet. So I think Batman Forever kind of started to unravel things for Val Kilmer. He and Marlon Brando just had zero desire to be collaborative with one another. It should also be noted that Robert Shea, the CEO of New Line Cinema, the production company of this film, had gone on to say how uninspired he was that Richard Stanley had Marlon Brando playing Dr. Moreau because he just finished filming Don Juan DeMarco with Johnny Depp and Marlon Brando. And even on Don Juan DeMarco, Marlon Brando was phoning it in. He was already doing the whole feed me the lines type of a deal. He was wearing an earpiece throughout the majority of filming Don Juan DeMarco, and that actually didn't stop when doing The Island of Dr. Moreau. His trusty earpiece was very well implanted and fully charged. So as I had stated, Robert Shea was just not looking forward to working with Marlon Brando again, but it's a name that carries quite a weight, so they went on and pursued the production with Brando. Not that it entirely dismisses their attitude while filming. They did both have a couple of really personal issues transpire while filming this movie. For example, Marlon Brando's daughter committed suicide while they were filming in Australia, so he wasn't even there to be with his daughter. He had to work out some kind of an issue to get his visa to fly back to America for the funeral procession. And that alone is just enough to want to be dismissed from a film, which he easily had the right to do so. But he decided to continue on with the film to the shock of many people on the cast and crew. You know, if anybody's daughter died, it's just kind of odd that you would continue on with the production no matter how important it was. It's something similar to Zack Snyder when he was filming Justice League and his daughter committed suicide while he was filming Justice League. He completely resigned from the role, and that's when they brought in Joss Whedon to finish the film for him. There's no real excuse or any kind of explanation as to why Brando decided to stay on the film. I guess maybe that was his way of trying to deal with the loss. I mean, you get lost in your work. That's what people do sometimes. You know, not that that is really an excuse. If you're going to do the film, you might want to still be a bit professional. And if you can't, then again, go home. Nobody's requiring you to be there, especially after such a devastating loss as that. Not that it really compares the same, but Val Kilmer was filed for divorce while he was filming from actress Joanne Whalley, who actually played Saoirse, his love interest in Willow. And yes, they were married. And apparently she just, you know, found this as the best opportunity to tell him that, hey, you know what? I don't want to be married to you anymore. We've had a lot of problems. So she had her processor fly all the way to Australia, and reportedly he had received his divorce papers just after they had finished wrapping for the day. So that was a nice closing gift. And that kind of put Kilmer on a weird tailspin. Like, he didn't want to leave, but he also, somewhat similar to Brando, he wanted to get lost in the work, but he was acting really bizarre to the cast and the crew, and he was doing weird stuff to the cast, and he was burning hair on the costumes of some of the extras, and just really weird kink of burning people's hair. I mean, nobody really got lit up or torched or anything, but I just thought that was kind of an odd behavior. And he really got lost in this role. Now, if you've seen this movie and you see what happens to his character, it actually feels method how he just kind of devolves into the character that he's playing. And it turns out to be probably his most personal acting performance he's done. It became kind of a pissing contest between Brando and Kilmer. They were trying to control the set. They were trying to see what they could get away with, what they could do. Brando alone was trying to change the set, the costumes, the lines. He even added an extra who was played by this, at the time, the Guinness World Record for the world's smallest man, this Nelson De La Rosa. And he was an extra, and Brando looked at this guy and said, "He's magnificent. He's amazing. Why is he not one of the central figures?" And, you know, the cast and crew were saying, well, he can't speak English. I mean, he's very visually engaging, but that wasn't enough for Brando. Brando had to have this character. And now, when I tell you this guy was small, this guy was the smallest man at one point, held the Guinness record. He was 1 foot and 10 and a half inches tall, and he weighed a max of 22 pounds. Now, this guy, again, he couldn't speak English, but he didn't want him to speak anyway. He just basically wanted him to follow him around the set, on and off of the set. I mean, he just really took a liking to this particular individual, so much so that he had him written in as basically his mini-me in the movie. And I almost want to believe, now, I couldn't back this up with any kind of evidence, but I want to believe that Mike Myers was inspired to write mini-me for Austin Powers based on Brando and his extra friend here that he brought on to have a major role in the movie. And he does have a major role in the movie. He's basically with Dr. Moreau in every scene that he's in. He dresses exactly like him. There's even this really bizarre scene in the movie where he has a little mini piano on top of Dr. Moreau's piano playing exactly like Dr. Evil and Mini-Me do. So I just found that to be quite a story. And I mean, great for Nelson De La Rosa to get bumped up from an extra to one of the main characters in the entire movie. So these were the type of things that Brando was doing. And he would also, like I said, he would change his costume. There was a situation where he was feeling so hot while filming in the jungle that they basically had to write in a scene where he has this bizarre metal cylinder on top of his head, and actress Fairuza Balk has to apply ice into this hat thing. And it doesn't make any sense for the movie, but all it's really doing is just keeping Brando cool. But here they are. They had to fashion this weird bucket thing on his head to basically look like a costume. And there's not even any kind of lines of dialogue or any kind of exposition to explain why Fairuza Balk is pouring ice into this bucket. I guess it's just to assume, oh, well, it's cooling him off. But what is this? Is this some kind of power charger or something? It doesn't make any sense. It's quite the visual. And I actually wanted to play an audio from an interview that Fairuza Balk had done. Fairuza Balk, if you're not familiar with her work, she actually played Nancy in The Craft. She played Vicky Valancourt in The Waterboy with Adam Sandler. And she was an Almost Famous. She's a very prominent actress. Like, if you saw her, you would know who she was. She's got a very visual look to her. And I'm going to play an interview that she had done about working with Brando on this movie.
I remember Frankenheimer trying to talk to him about the scene and Marlon saying, no, 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 no. instead of it being about violence and all this pain and suffering, I think that all of the animal people should get together and there should be a grand celebration like a bar mitzvah. And I thought, he's fucking with them. Just one day I said, can we talk? And he said, what is it, dear? And I said, I don't know, just in terms of our characters and how they relate, I'd love to have some time to do that. And he said, no, this is all insane. I'm getting paid. You're getting paid. None of the scripts make any sense, so why worry? You know, just relax. Do what you're doing. You're beautiful. Don't worry about it. And I said, but I mean, how the characters relate. Isn't there... I didn't read the script.
I know I didn't go into much detail of the plot of this movie, but basically it's about a scientist who is trying to genetically recode human DNA with animal DNA, and what ends up happening are a bunch of hybrid individuals. So you basically have a grown man in the shape of a lion, and you know, just kind of stuff like that. Well, in order to achieve the effects, Stan Winston's Creature Factory came in and had all these extras dressed up, and they applied all of these really, really impressive animatronics to the costumes to make them look animalistic, to make them look like, you know, hybrids of animals. And in order to achieve this process, these extras had to sit in the makeup and costume trailers for 3 to 5 hours a day, applying all of these types of things that they needed to achieve this look. So it was quite a process, and something that Brando and or Kilmer just didn't have the patience for. When they were ready to act, they wanted it to be done now and immediate. So some of the shots that they had, the actors aren't even in the same room with the final creatures. And of course, they were creating a problem by saying, how am I supposed to act with the animal if they're not here? So for some odd reason, the crew had to put on these like burlap cloaks and blankets to make them look animalistic, because apparently that was enough for Brando and Kilmer to work against. But the director, Frankenheimer, wanted the animals to be in the same room as the actors, so they pushed back the preparation time to about 3 o'clock in the morning, so that way by the time that they were ready to go at around 6 or 7 in the morning, hopefully Brando and Kilmer would be too. But there were many days where Brando and Kilmer had to have their little petty squabble, and neither of them would come out of their trailer until the other one did. And so it would leave the cast and crew waiting after spending all this time getting ready to shoot, and it just became such a major problem. Well, Brando decided that he had enough of the cast and crew, and he even had enough of CEO Bob Shea, because he was putting in place a situation to topple him and have him removed as CEO of the company, the production company that was producing this movie. So I'm going to play an interview that Robert Shea had done. Now, Robert Shea, of course, is CEO of New Line. He's the creator of Freddy Krueger and A Nightmare on Elm Street and a couple of other horror properties from New Line Cinema in the 80s. So he was pretty prominently featured for doing that. But I'm going to play an interview that he had done talking about working with Brando.
Frankenheimer actually called me at one point. And again, it was one of those, you don't know me, but I have to talk to the head of the company. So what is it? He said, this is complete insanity here. And I have to tell you, I've dealt with some very, very difficult actors in my life, but I have never, ever dealt with somebody like Marlon Brando. He said, we're driving, and he stops the car and says, let's fuck Bob Shea. And I said, this is John saying to me, and I said, well, why? He seems like a pretty nice guy. Why should we do that? So, well, he doesn't know what he's doing. And I think what we should do is just close down the production. And you and I are going to rewrite the script, and we'll spend 6 or 8 weeks rewriting it, because I have some ideas about how Dr. Moreau should be wearing a hat all the time, and at the end of the movie takes off his hat and he's actually a dolphin. So then I knew we were in serious, serious bad shape.
Now, I wanted to close this episode by talking about my favorite story to come out of this production. Now, we're going back to director Richard Stanley, right? Apparently, there were a large group of hippies that lived in the forest where they were filming, and some of them were even brought in as extras. And I mean, all they really ended up doing was getting high with the cast and crew and sleeping with half of them. So it just became this weird, just kind of boink fest, and encased with the drugs and stuff like that. But Richard Stanley was actually living with them in their own residential areas. They were living in these huts and cabins that were built alongside the river, and he never left. He never left Australia. He ended up staying there after being fired. And what is so hilarious about this was that he was living as a fisherman, waiting his contract out, because he was still getting paid. Although he was fired, he was still paid in full. So what he actually would do was he would sneak back onto the set, and he was dressed as one of the animal extras. As, like I said, the cast and crew loved Richard Stanley, especially the crew. They were more than happy to dress him up as one of the animal extras every single day. He wore this Dogman costume, and nobody knew except for a few loyal crewmen. And you can actually see him in this dog costume in the final print of the movie, which is absolutely hilarious, because the scene will have Val Kilmer, Marlon Brando, pretty much everybody that did not like him. And he almost got the last laugh with this movie, because the last laugh essentially became the box office, as this movie was a box office disaster. It was predicated on this notion that it was going to be a huge hit and they were going to make a series of Dr. Moreau movies. But as it happens, it didn't take place because, again, it wasn't necessarily a bad movie. If you watch this movie, which is currently streaming on YouTube and anywhere else you could find it, probably on Tubi, but this movie actually isn't that bad. It's one of those movies where you hear about a tumultuous production crew and a production for the making of the movie, but it actually turned out that it was a pretty decent movie, and the special effects are really, really good. And of course, that happens to be with Stan Winston's company. But again, the final product of this movie actually turned out to be a lot better than the production itself. Now, if you like this episode, please go ahead and follow the page on TikTok. We do a lot of short videos on there. We're on TikTok, Instagram at @real_problems_podcast. If you want to follow me, I'm at @cinema_Steven. I typically share in the same realm of things, but we are also streaming this episode on all major podcasting platforms. If you listen on Google Podcasts, please note that they are changing it to YouTube Podcasts, so to make the transition over there. And if you like this episode, please also follow and listen to the Screen Addicts podcast. It's my other podcast where I basically talk about movies and TV. There's a topic of the week, and I am sharing co-hosting duties with my longtime compadre, Chris TV Viegas. And that is, of course, on all major platforms as well. And if you had any kinds of questions or omissions or corrections you would like to submit, please do so at realproblemspodcast@gmail.com. I'm compiling up quite a few letters, as you know. I'm getting a couple of emails here that I didn't know certain things that I will be sharing on a later episode. I might do it as a collective extra, but I haven't really decided yet. But again, thank you for listening. This was The Real Problems with the Island of Dr. Moreau. I am Cinema Steven, and that's a wrap.